darkness everywhere. I had to concentrate. I wasn't looking forward to driving back.
Keep going.
We did 8 or 9 more miles. I had no idea where we were.
Okay, pretty soon we should see Duke waiting up ahead.
1.5 miles later, my headlight beams picked out Duke's rear plate. He was parked on the shoulder. His car was canted over where the grade fell away into a ditch.
Stop behind him.
I pulled up nose to tail with the Lincoln and jammed the selector into park. I wanted to go to sleep. 5 minutes would have made a lot of difference to me. But Duke swung out of his seat as soon as he identified us and hurried around to Beck's window. Beck buzzed the glass down, and Duke squatted and leaned his face inside.
Their place is about 2 miles ahead. Long, curved driveway on the left. Not much more than a dirt path. We can make it about halfway up in the cars if we do it quiet and slow, no lights. We'll have to walk the rest of the way.
Beck said nothing, just buzzed his window up again. Duke went back to his car. It bounced off the shoulder and straightened up. I followed him through the 2 miles. We killed our lights 100 yards short of the driveway and made the turn. Took it slow. There was some moonlight. The Lincoln ahead of me lurched and rolled as it crawled over ruts. The Cadillac did the same thing, out of phase, up where the Lincoln was down, corkscrewing right where the Lincoln was twisting left. We slowed to a crawl, used idle speed to inch us closer. Then Duke's brake lights flared bright, and he stopped dead. I stopped behind him. Beck twisted around in his seat and hauled a sports bag through the gap between us and unzipped it on his knee, handed me one of the MP5Ks from it, with 2 spare 30-round magazines.
Get the job done.
You waiting here? He nodded. I broke the gun down and checked it, put it back together, and jacked around into the chamber and clicked the safety on. Then I put the spare mags in my pockets very carefully so they wouldn't rattle against the Glock and the PSM, eased myself out of the car, stood and breathed the cold night air. It was a relief. It woke me up. I could smell a lake nearby, and trees, and leaf mold on the ground. I could hear a small waterfall in the distance, and the mufflers on the cars ticking gently as they cooled. There was a gentle breeze in the trees. Other than that, there was nothing to hear, just absolute silence. Duke was waiting for me. I could see tension and impatience in the way he was holding himself. He had done this stuff before. That was clear. He looked exactly like a veteran cop before a major bust. Some degree of routine familiarity, mixed in with an acute awareness that no two situations are ever quite alike. He had his stire in his hand, with the long 30-round magazine in it. It protruded way down out of the grip, made the gun look bigger and uglier than ever.
"Let's go, asshole," he whispered.
I stayed 5 feet behind him and walked on the opposite side of the driveway, like an infantryman would. I had to be convincing, like I was worried about presenting a grouped target. I knew the place was going to be empty, but he didn't. We walked on around a bend and saw the house in front of us. There was a light burning in a window, on a security timer, probably. Duke slowed and stopped.
"See a door?" he whispered.
I peered into the gloom, saw a small porch, pointed at it.
"You wait at the entrance," I whispered back. "I'll check the lighted window."
He was happy enough to agree to that. We made it to the porch. He stopped there and waited, and I peeled off and looped around toward the window, dropped to the ground and crawled the last 10 feet in the dirt, raised my head at the sill, and peered inside. There was a low wattage bulb burning in a table lamp with a yellow plastic shade. There were battered sofas and armchairs, cold ash from an old fire in the hearth, pine paneling on the walls. No people. I crawled backward until the light spill let Duke see me and held 2 forked fingers below my eyes. Standard sniper spotter visual code for "I see." Then I held my palm out, all my fingers extended. "I see 5 people. Then I went into a complicated series of gestures that might have indicated their disposition and their weaponry. I knew Duke wouldn't understand them. I didn't understand them either. As far as I knew, they were entirely meaningless. I had never been a sniper spotter. But the whole thing looked real good. It looked professional and clandestine and urgent. I crawled back 10 more feet and then stood up and walked quietly back to join him at the door.
"They're out of it," I whispered. "Drunk or stoned. We get a good jump, we'll be home and dry."
"Weapons?"
"Plenty, but nothing within reach."
I pointed at the porch.
"Looks like there's going to be a short hallway on the other side. Outer door, inner door, then the hallway. You take left, I'll take right. We'll wait there in the hallway. Take them down when they come out of the room to see what the noise is all about."
"You giving the orders now?"
"I did the recon."
"Just don't screw up, asshole."
"You either."
"I never do," he said.
"Okay."
"I mean it," he said. "You get in my way, I'll be more than happy to put you down with the rest of them. No hesitation."
"We're on the same side here."
"Are we? I think we're about to find out."
"Relax," I said.
He paused, tensed, nodded in the dark.
"I'll hit the outer door, you hit the inner, like leapfrog."
"Okay," I said again.
I turned away and smiled. Just like a veteran cop. If I hit the inner door, he would leapfrog through it first, and I would go second. And the second guy is the guy who usually gets shot, given normal reaction times from the enemy.
"Safety's off," I whispered.
I clicked the H and K to single round fire, and he clicked the catch on his stire to the right. I nodded, and he nodded, and kicked in the outer door. I was right there on his shoulder and slid past him and kicked in the inner door without breaking stride. He slid past me and jumped left, and I followed him and went right. He was good enough. We made a pretty good team. We were crouched in perfect position even before the shattered doors had stopped swinging on their hinges. He was staring ahead at the entry to the room in front of us. He had the stire in a fixed, two-handed grip, arms straight out, eyes wide open. He was breathing hard, almost panting, getting himself through a long moment of danger the best way he could. I pulled Angel Doll's PSM out of my pocket, held it left-handed, and snicked the safety off, and scrambled across the floor and jammed it in his ear.
"Keep very quiet," I said to him, "and make a choice. I'm going to ask you one question, just one. If you lie, or if you refuse to answer, I'm going to shoot you in the head. You understand?"
He held perfectly still. 5 seconds. 6. 8, 10, stared desperately at the door in front of him.
"Don't worry, asshole," I said. "There's nobody here. They were all arrested last week by the government."
He was motionless. "You understand what I said before about the question?" He nodded hesitantly, awkwardly, with the gun still jammed hard in his ear. "You answer it, or I'll shoot you in the head. Got it?" He nodded again.
"Okay, here it comes. You ready?"
He nodded just once.
"Where is Teresa Daniel?"
There was a long pause. He turned half toward me. I tracked my hand around to keep the PSM's muzzle in place. Realization dawned slowly in his eyes.
"In your dreams," he said.
I shot him in the head, just jerked the muzzle out of his ear, and fired once, left-handed, into his right temple. The sound was shattering in the dark. Blood and brain and bone chips hit the far wall. The muzzle flash burned his hair. Then I fired a double tap from the H&K, right-handed, into the ceiling, and fired another from the PSM, left-handed, into the floor. Switched the H&K to automatic fire and stood up and emptied it point-blank into his body. Picked up his stire from where it had fallen and blasted the ceiling with it again and again. 15 fast shots, bam, 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 half the magazine. The hallway was instantly full of bitter smoke, and chips of wood and plaster were flying everywhere. I switched magazines on the H&K and sprayed the walls all around. The noise was deafening. Spent shell cases were spitting out and bouncing around and raining down everywhere. The H&K clicked empty, and I fired the rest of the PSM's ammo into the hallway wall and kicked open the door to the lighted room and blew up the table lamp with the stire. I found a side table and tossed it through the window and used up the second spare magazine for the H&K by spraying the trees in the distance while I fired the stire left-handed into the floor until it clicked empty. Then I piled the stire and the H&K and the PSM together in my arms and ran for it with my head ringing like a bell. I had fired 128 rounds in about 15 seconds. They had deafened me. They must have sounded like World War III to Beck. I ran straight down the driveway. I was coughing and trailing gun smoke like a cloud. I headed for the cars. Beck had already scrambled across into the Cadillac's driver's seat. He saw me coming and opened his door an inch, faster than using the window. "Ambush," I said. I was out of breath, and I could hear my own voice loud inside my head. "There were at least 8 of them." "Where's Duke?" "Dead. We gotta go, right now, Beck." He froze for a second, then he moved.
"Take his car," he said.
He already had the Cadillac rolling. He jammed his foot down and slammed his door and reversed down the driveway and out of sight. I jumped into the Lincoln, fired it up, stuck the selector in reverse, and got one elbow up on the back of the seat and stared through the rear window and hit the gas. We shot out backward onto the road one after the other and slewed around and took off again north, side by side like a stoplight drag race. We howled around the curves and fought the camber and stayed up around 70 miles an hour. Didn't slow until we reached the turn that would take us back toward Hartford. Beck edged ahead of me, and I fell in behind him and followed. He drove 5 fast miles and turned in at a closed package store and parked at the back of the lot. I parked 10 feet from him and just lay back in the seat and let him come to me. I was too tired to get out. He ran around the Cadillac's hood and pulled my door open.
"You was an ambush?" he said.
I nodded. "They were waiting for us. 8 of them. Maybe more. It was a massacre." He said nothing. There was nothing for him to say. I picked up Duke Steyer from the seat beside me and handed it over. I recovered it.
"Why?"
"I thought you might want me to. I thought it might be traceable." He nodded.
"It isn't. But that was good thinking."
I gave him the H&K, too. He stepped back to the Cadillac, and I watched him zip both pieces into his bag. Then he turned around, clenched both hands, and looked up at the black sky, then at me.
"See any faces?"
I shook my head. "Too dark. But we hit one of them. He dropped this." I handed him the PSM. It was like punching him in the gut. He turned pale and put out a hand and steadied himself against the Lincoln's roof. "What?" I said. He looked away.
"I don't believe it."
"What?"
"You hit somebody and he dropped this?"
"I think Duke hit him."
"You saw it happen?"
"Just shapes. It was dark. Lots of muzzle flashes. Duke was firing and he hit his shape and this was on the floor when I came out."
"This is Angel Dow's gun."
"You sure?"
1,000,000 to 1 it isn't. You know what it is?"
"Never saw one like it."
"It's a special KGB pistol from the old Soviet Union. Very rare in this country."
Then he stepped away into the darkness of the lot. I closed my eyes. I wanted to sleep. Even 5 seconds would have made a difference.
"Reacher," he called. "What evidence did you leave?"
I opened my eyes. "Duke's body."
"That won't lead anybody anywhere. Ballistics?"
I smiled in the dark, imagined Hartford PD forensic scientists trying to make sense of the trajectories, walls, floors, ceilings. They would conclude the hallway had been full of heavily armed disco dancers.
"A lot of bullets and shell cases."
"Untraceable," he said.
He moved deeper into the dark. I closed my eyes again. I had left no fingerprints. No part of me had touched any part of the house except for the soles of my shoes. And I hadn't fired Duffy's Glock. I had heard something about a central registry somewhere that stored data on rifling marks. Maybe her Glock was a part of it, but I hadn't used it.
"Reacher, drive me home."
I opened my eyes.
"What about this car?"
"Abandon it here."
I yawned and forced myself to move and used the tail of my coat to wipe the wheel and all the controls I had touched. The unused Glock nearly fell out of my pocket. Beck didn't notice. He was so preoccupied I could have taken it out and twirled it around my finger like the Sundance Kid and he wouldn't have noticed. I wiped the door handle and then leaned in and pulled the keys and wiped them and tossed them into the scrub at the edge of the lot.
"Let's go."
Beck was silent until we were 30 miles north and east of Hartford. Then he started talking. He had spent the time getting it all worked out in his mind.
The phone call yesterday? They were laying their plans. Dahl was working with them all along.
From when?
From the start.
That doesn't make sense. Duke went south and got the Toyota's plate number for you. Then you gave it to Dahl and told him to trace it. But why would Dahl tell you the truth about the trace? If they were his buddies, he'd have dead-ended it, surely. Led you away from them, left you in the dark.
Beck smiled a superior smile. Nah. They were setting up the ambush. That was the point of the phone call. It was good improvisation on their part. The kidnap gambit failed, so they switched tactics. They let Dahl point us in the right direction, so that what happened tonight could happen.
I nodded slowly, like I was deferring to his point of view. The best way to clinch a pending promotion is to let them think you're just a little dumber than they are. It had worked for me before, 3 straight times in the military. Did Dahl actually know what you were planning for tonight?
Yes. We were all discussing it yesterday, in detail, when you saw us talking in the office.
So he set you up?
Yes. He locked up last night and then left Portland and drove all the way down to wait with them. Told them all who was coming, and when, and why.
I said nothing, just thought about Dahl's car. It was about a mile away from Beck's office. I began to wish I had hidden it better.
But there's one big question, Beck said.
Was it just Dahl? Or? He went quiet. Then he shrugged.
Or any of the others that work with him?
The ones you don't control, I thought. Quinn's people.
Or all of them together, he said.
He started thinking again. Another 30-40 miles. He didn't speak another word until we were back on I-95, heading north around Boston.
Duke is dead.
I'm sorry, I said.
Here it comes, I thought. I knew him a long time.
I said nothing.
You're going to have to take over. I need somebody right now, somebody I can trust. And you've done well for me so far.
Promotion?
You're qualified.
Head of security?
At least temporarily. Permanently, if you'd like.
I don't know.
Just remember what I know. I own you.
I was quiet for a mile. You gonna pay me anytime soon?
You'll get your 5 grand plus what Duke got on top.
I'll need some background. I can't help you without it.
He nodded. Tomorrow. We'll talk tomorrow.
Then he went quiet again. Next time I looked, he was fast asleep beside me. Some kind of a shock reaction. He thought his world was falling apart. I fought to stay awake and keep the car on the road, and I thought back to texts I had read from the British Army in India during the Raj at the height of their empire. Young subalterns trapped in junior ranks had their own mess. They would dine together in splendid dress uniforms and talk about their chances of promotion, but they had none, unless a superior officer died. Dead men's shoes was the rule. So they would raise their crystal glasses of fine French wine and toast bloody wars and dread diseases, because a casualty further up the chain of command was their only way to get ahead. Brutal. But that's how it's always been in the military. I made it back to the main coast purely on autopilot. I couldn't recall a single mile of the drive. I was numb with exhaustion. Every part of me ached. Paulie was slow about opening the gate. I guess we got him out of bed. He made a big point about staring in at me. I dropped Beck at the front door and put the car in the garage, stashed the Glock and the spare magazines just for safety's sake, and went in through the back door. The metal detector beeped at the car keys. I dropped them on the kitchen table. I was hungry, but I was too tired to eat. I climbed all the stairs and fell down on my bed and went to sleep, fully dressed, overcoat and shoes and all. The weather woke me 6 hours later. Horizontal rain was battering my window. It sounded like gravel on the glass. I rolled off the bed and checked the view. The sky was iron gray and thick with cloud, and the sea was raging. It was laced with angry foam a half mile out. The waves were swamping the rocks. No birds. It was 9 in the morning, day 14, a Friday. I lay down on the bed again and stared at the ceiling and tracked back 72 hours to the morning of day 11, when Duffy gave me her 7-point plan. 1, 2, and 3, take a lot of care. I was doing okay under that heading. I was still alive anyway. 4, find Teresa Daniel. No real progress there. 5, nail down some evidence against Beck. I didn't have any. Not a thing. I hadn't even seen him do anything wrong, except maybe operate a vehicle with phony license plates and carry a bag full of submachine guns that were probably illegal in all 4 states he'd been in. 6, find Quinn. No progress there, either. 7, get the hell out. That item was going to have to wait. Then Duffy had kissed me on the cheek, left donut sugar on my face. I got up again and locked myself in my bathroom to check for email. My bedroom door wasn't locked anymore. I guessed Richard Beck wouldn't presume to walk in on me, or his mother, but his father might. He owned me. I was promoted, but I was still walking a tightrope. I sat on the floor and took my shoe off, opened the heel, and switched the machine on. You've got mail. It was a message from Duffy. Beck's containers unloaded and trucked to warehouse, not inspected by customs. Total of 5. Largest shipment for some time. I hit reply and typed, "Are you maintaining surveillance?" 90 seconds later, she answered, "Yes." I sent, "I got promoted." She sent, "Exploited." I sent, "I enjoyed yesterday." She sent, "Save your battery." I smiled and switched the unit off and put it back in my heel. I needed a shower, but first I needed breakfast, and then I needed to find clean clothes. I unlocked the bathroom and walked through my room and downstairs to the kitchen. The cook was back in business. She was serving toast and tea to the Irish girl and dictating a long shopping list. The Saab keys were on the table. The Cadillac keys weren't. I scratched around and ate everything I could find, and then went looking for Beck. He wasn't around. Neither was Elizabeth or Richard. I went back to the kitchen. "Where's the family?" I asked. The maid looked up and said nothing. She had put a raincoat on, ready to go out shopping.
"Where's Mr. Duke?"
the cook asked.
"Indisposed," I said.
"I'm replacing him. Where are the Becks?"
"They went out."
"Where to?"
"I don't know."
I looked out at the weather. "Who drove?" The cook looked down at the floor.
"Pauly."
"When?"
"An hour ago."
"Okay," I said. I was still wearing my coat. I had put it on when I left Duffy's motel, and I hadn't taken it off since. I went straight out the back door and into the gale. The rain was lashing, and it tasted of salt. It was mixed with sea spray. The waves were hitting the rocks like bombs. White foam was bursting 30 feet in the air. I ducked my face into my collar and ran around to the garage block, into the walled courtyard. It was sheltered in there. The first garage was empty. The doors were standing open. The Cadillac was gone. The mechanic was inside the third garage, doing something by himself. The maid ran into the courtyard. I watched her haul open the fourth garage's doors. She was getting soaked. She went in, and a moment later backed the old Saab out. It rocked in the wind. The rain turned the dust on it to a thin film of gray mud that ran down the sides like rivers. She drove away, off to market. I listened to the waves, started worrying about how high they might be getting, so I hugged the courtyard wall and looped all the way around it to the seaward side, found my little dip in the rocks. The weed stalks around it were wet and bedraggled. The dip was full of water. It was rainwater, not seawater. It was safely above the tide. The waves hadn't reached it. But rainwater was all it was full of. Apart from the water, it was completely empty. No bundle, no rag, no Glock. The spare magazines were gone, Dahl's keys were gone, the brad awl was gone, and the chisel was gone. Chapter 8. I came around to the front of the house and faced west, and stood in the lashing rain and stared at the high stone wall. Right at that moment, I came as close as I ever got to bailing out. It would have been easy. The gate was wide open. I guessed the maid had left it that way. She had gotten out in the rain to open it, and she hadn't wanted to get out again to close it. Paulie wasn't there to do it for her. He was out driving the Cadillac. So the gate was open and unguarded. The first time I had ever seen it that way. I could have slipped straight through it. But I didn't. I stayed. Time was part of the reason. Beyond the gate was at least 12 miles of empty road before the first significant turning. 12 miles, and there were no cars to use. The Becks were out in the Cadillac, and the maid was out in the Saab. We had abandoned the Lincoln in Connecticut, so I would be on foot. 3 hours fast walk. I didn't have 3 hours. Almost certainly the Cadillac would return within 3 hours, and there was nowhere to hide on the road. The shoulders were bare and rocky. It was an exposed situation. Beck would pass me head on. I would be walking. He would be in a car. And he had a gun. And Paulie. I had nothing. Therefore, strategy was part of the reason, too. To be caught in the act of walking away would confirm whatever Beck might think he knew, assuming it was Beck who had discovered the stash. But if I stayed, I had some kind of a chance. Staying would imply innocence. I could deflect suspicion onto Duke. I could say it must have been Duke's stash. Beck might find that plausible. Maybe. Duke had enjoyed the freedom to go wherever he wanted, any time of night or day. I had been locked up and supervised the whole time. And Duke wasn't around anymore to deny anything. But I would be right there in Beck's face, talking loud and fast and persuasive. He might buy it. Hope was part of the reason, too. Maybe it wasn't Beck who had found the stash. Maybe it was Richard, walking the shoreline. His reaction would be unpredictable. I figured it at 50-50 whether he would approach me or his father first. Or maybe it was Elizabeth who had found it. She was familiar with the rocks out there. She knew them well, knew their secrets. I guessed she had spent plenty of time on them, for one reason or another, and her reaction would favor me. Probably. The rain was part of the reason for staying, too. It was cold and hard and relentless. I was too tired to road march 3 hours in the rain. I knew it was just weakness, but I couldn't move my feet. I wanted to go back inside the house. I wanted to get warm and eat again and rest. Fear of failure was part of the reason, too. If I walked away now, I would never come back. I knew that. And I had invested 2 weeks. I had made good progress. People were depending on me. I had been beaten many times, but I had never just quit. Not once. Not ever. If I quit now, it would eat me up the rest of my days. Jack Reacher. Quitter. Walked away when the going got tough. I stood there with the rain driving against my back. Time, strategy, hope, the weather, fear of failure. All parts of the reason for staying, all right there on the list. But top of the list was a woman. Not Susan Duffy, not Teresa Daniel. A woman from long ago, from another life. She was called Dominique Cole. I was a captain in the army when I met her. I was 1 year away from my final promotion to major. I got to my office early one morning and found the usual stack of paperwork on my desk. Most of it was junk. But among it was a copy of an order assigning an E-7 Sergeant First Class D.E. Cole to my unit. Back then, we were in a phase where all written references to personnel had to be gender neutral. The name Cole sounded German to me, and I pictured some big, ugly guy from Texas or Minnesota. Big red hands, big red face, older than me, maybe 35, with a white wall haircut. Later in the morning, the clerk buzzed through to say the guy was reporting for duty. I made him wait 10 minutes, just for the fun of it, and then called him in. But the him was a her, and she wasn't big and ugly. She was wearing a skirt. She was about 29 years old. She wasn't tall, but she was too athletic to be called petite, and she was too pretty to be called athletic. It was like she had been exquisitely molded from the stuff they make the inside of tennis balls out of. There was an elasticity about her, a firmness and a softness, all at the same time. She looked sculpted, but she had no hard edges. She stood rigidly at attention in front of my desk and snapped a smart salute. I didn't return it, which was rude of me. I just stared at her for 5 whole seconds. Eddie, Sergeant. She handed me her copy of her orders and her personnel file. We called them service jackets. They contained everything anybody needed to know. I left her standing easy in front of me while I read hers through, which was rude of me, too, but there was no other option. I didn't have a visitor's chair. Back then, the Army didn't provide them below the rank of full colonel. She stood completely still, hands clasped behind her back, staring at a point in the air exactly a foot above my head. Her jacket was impressive. She had done a little of everything and succeeded at it all in spectacular fashion. Expert marksman, specialist in a number of skills, tremendous arrest record, excellent clear-up percentage. She was a good leader and had been promoted fast. She had killed 2 people, one with a firearm, one unarmed. Both incidents rated righteous by the subsequent investigating panels. She was a rising star. That was clear. I realized that her transfer represented a substantial compliment to me, in some superior's mind. "Glad to have you aboard," I said.
"Sir, thank you, sir," she said,
with her eyes fixed in space. "I don't do all that shit. I'm not afraid I'm going to vaporize if you look at me, and I don't really like one sir in a sentence, let alone 2, okay?"
"Okay," she said.
She caught on fast. She never called me sir again. The whole rest of her life. "Want to jump right in at the deep end?" I asked. She nodded.
"Sure."
I rattled open a drawer and slid a slim file out and passed it across to her. She didn't look at it, just held it one-handed down by her side and looked at me. "Aberdeen, Maryland," I said, "at the proving grounds. There's a weapons designer acting weird. Confidential tip from a buddy who's worried about espionage, but I think it's more likely blackmail. Could be a long and sensitive investigation."
"No problem," she said.
She was the reason I didn't walk out through the open and unguarded gate. I went inside, instead, and took a long, hot shower. Nobody likes to risk confrontation when they're wet and naked, but I was way past caring. I guess I was feeling fatalistic. Whatever, bring it on. Then I wrapped up in a towel and went down a flight and found Duke's room. Stole another set of his clothes. I dressed in them and put my own shoes and jacket and coat on. Went back to the kitchen to wait. It was warm in there. The way the sea was pounding and the rain was beating on the windows made it feel warmer still. It was like a sanctuary. The cook was in there, doing something with a chicken. "Got coffee?" I asked her. She shook her head. "Why not?" "Caffeine," she said. I looked at the back of her head. "Caffeine is the whole point of coffee. Anyway, tea's got caffeine, and I've seen you make that.
Tea has tannin.
And caffeine.
So drink tea instead."
I looked around the room. There was a wooden block standing vertically on a counter with black knife handles protruding at angles. There were bottles and glasses. I guessed under the sink there might be ammonia sprays. Maybe some chlorine bleach. Enough improvised weapons for a close-quarters fight. If Beck was even a little inhibited about shooting in a crowded room, I might be okay. I might be able to take him before he took me. All I would need was half a second.
"You want coffee?" the cook asked. "Is that what you're saying?"
"Yes, it is."
"All you have to do is ask."
I did ask.
"No, you asked if there was any. Not the same thing."
So will you make me some, please?
What happened to Mr. Duke?
I paused. Maybe she was planning on marrying him, like in old movies where the cook marries the butler and they retire and live happily ever after.
He was killed, I said.
Last night?
In an ambush.
Where?
In Connecticut.
Okay. I'll make you some coffee.
She set the machine going. I watched where she got everything from. The filter papers were stored in a cupboard next to the paper napkins. The coffee itself was in the freezer. The machine was old and slow. It made a loud, ponderous, gulping sound. Combined with the rain lashing on the windows and the waves pounding on the rocks, it meant I didn't hear the Cadillac come back. First I knew, the back door was thrown open, and Elizabeth Beck burst in with Richard crowding after her, and Beck himself bringing up the rear. They were moving with the kind of exhilarated, breathless urgency people show after a short, fast dash through heavy rain.
"Hello?"
Elizabeth said to me. I nodded, said nothing.
"Coffee," Richard said. "Great."
"We went out for breakfast," Elizabeth said. "Old Orchard Beach. There's a little diner there we like."
"Paulie figured we shouldn't wake you," Beck said. "He figured you looked pretty tired last night, so he offered to drive us instead."
"Okay," I said. Thought, did Paulie find my stash? Did he tell them yet?
"You want coffee?"
Richard asked me. He was over by the machine, rattling cups in his hand.
"Black," I said. "Thanks."
He brought me a cup. Beck was peeling off his coat and shaking water off it onto the floor.
"Bring it through," he called. "We need to talk."
He headed out to the hallway and looked back like he expected me to follow him. I took my coffee with me. It was hot and steaming. I could toss it in his face if I had to. He led me toward the square paneled room we had used before. I was carrying my cup, which slowed me down a little. He got there well ahead of me. When I entered, he was already all the way over by one of the windows with his back to me, looking out at the rain. When he turned around, he had a gun in his hand. I just stood still. I was too far away to use the coffee. Maybe 14 feet. It would have looped up and curled and dispersed in the air and probably missed him altogether. The gun was a Beretta M9 Special Edition, which was a civilian Beretta 92FS, all dressed up to look exactly like a standard military-issue M9. It used 9mm Parabellum ammunition. It had a 15-round magazine and military dot-and-post sights. I remembered with bizarre clarity that the retail price had been $861. I had carried an M9 for 13 years. I had fired many thousands of practice rounds with it, and more than a few for real. Most of them had hit their targets, because it's an accurate weapon. Most of the targets had been destroyed, because it's a powerful weapon. It had served me well. I even remembered the original sales pitch from the ordnance people. It's got manageable recoil, and it's easy to strip in the field. They had repeated it like a mantra, over and over again. I guess there were contracts at stake. There was some controversy. Navy SEALs hated it. They claimed they had had dozens blow up in their faces. They even made up a cadence song about it. "No way are you a Navy SEAL until you eat some Italian steel." But the M9 always served me well. It was a fine weapon, in my opinion. Beck's example looked like a brand new gun. The finish was immaculate, dewy with oil. There was luminescent paint on the sights. It glowed softly in the gloom. I waited. Beck just stood there, holding the gun. Then he moved. He slapped the barrel into his left palm and took his right hand away, leaned over the oak table and held the thing out to me, butt first, left-handed, politely, like he was a clerk in a store.
"Hope you like it," he said. "I thought you might feel at home with it. Duke was into the exotics, like that Steyr he had. But I figured you'd be more comfortable with the Beretta, you know, given your background."
I stepped forward, put my coffee on the table, took the gun from him.
ejected the magazine, checked the chamber, worked the action, looked down the barrel. It wasn't spiked. It wasn't a trick. It was a working piece. The parabellums were real. It was brand new. It had never been fired. I slapped it back together and just held it for a moment. It was like shaking hands with an old friend. Then I cocked it and locked it and put it in my pocket. "Thanks," I said. He put his hand in his own pocket and came out with two spare magazines.
"Take these,"
he said. He passed them across. I took them.
"I'll get you more later."
"Okay.
You ever tried laser sights?"
I shook my head.
"There's a company called Laser Devices. They do a universal handgun sight that mounts under the barrel, plus a little flashlight that clips under the sight. Very cool device."
"Gives a little red spot?" He nodded, smiled.
"Nobody likes to get lit up with that little red spot, that's for sure."
"Expensive?"
"Not really. Couple $100.
"How much weight does it add?"
4.5 ounces.
"All at the front?"
"It helps, actually. Stops the muzzle kicking upward when you fire. It adds about 13% of the weight of the gun. More with the flashlight, of course. Maybe 40, 45 ounces total. Still way less than those anacondas you were using. What were they, 59 ounces?
"Unloaded. More with 6 shells in them. Am I ever going to get them back?"
"I put them away somewhere. I'll get them for you later."
"Thanks."
"You want to try the laser?"
"I'm happy without it." He nodded again.
"Your choice. But I want the best protection I can get."
"Don't worry."
"I've got to go out now. Alone. I've got an appointment."
"You don't want me to drive you?"
"This sort of appointment I have to do them alone. You stay here. We'll talk later. Move into Duke's room, okay? I like my security closer to where I sleep."
I put the spare magazines in my other pocket. "Okay," I said. He walked past me into the hallway, back toward the kitchen. It was the kind of mental somersault that can slow you down. Extreme tension, and then extreme puzzlement. I walked to the front of the house and watched from a hallway window. Saw the Cadillac sweep around the carriage circle in the rain and head for the gate. It paused in front of it, and Paulie came out of the gatehouse. They must have dropped him there on their way back from breakfast. Beck must have driven the final length of the driveway himself. Or Richard, or Elizabeth. Paulie opened the gate. The Cadillac drove through it and away into the rain and the mist. Paulie closed the gate. He was wearing a slicker the size of a circus tent. I shook myself and turned back and went to find Richard. He had the kind of guileless eyes that hide nothing. He was still in the kitchen, drinking his coffee.
"You walked the shoreline this morning?" I asked him.
I asked it innocently and amiably, like I was just making conversation. If he had anything to hide, I would know. He would go red, look away, stammer, shuffle his feet. But he did none of those things. He was completely relaxed. He looked straight at me.
"Are you kidding? Seen the weather?"
I nodded. "Pretty bad."
"I'm quitting college."
"Why?"
"Because of last night. The ambush. Those Connecticut guys are still on the loose. Not safe to go back. I'm staying right here for a spell."
"You okay with that?" He nodded.
"It was mostly a waste of time."
I looked away. The law of unintended consequences. I had just short-circuited a kid's education. Maybe ruined his life. But then I was about to send his father to jail. Or waste him altogether. So I guess the B.A. didn't matter very much, compared to that. I went to find Elizabeth Beck. She would be harder to read. I debated my approach and couldn't come up with anything guaranteed to work. I found her in a parlor tucked into the northwest corner of the house. She was in an armchair. She had a book open on her lap. It was Dr. Zhivago by Boris Pasternak. Paperback. I had seen the movie. I remembered Julie Christie and the music. Lara's theme. Train journeys and a lot of snow. Some girl had made me go.
It's not you, she said.
What's not me?
You're not the government spy.
I breathed out. She wouldn't say that if she'd found my stash. Exactly, I said. Your husband just gave me a gun.
You're not smart enough to be a government spy.
Aren't I? She shook her head.
Richard was desperate for a cup of coffee just now, when we came in.
So?
Do you think he would have been if we'd really been out for breakfast? He could have had all the coffee he wanted.
So where did you go?
We were called to a meeting.
With who?
She just shook her head like she couldn't speak the name. Paulie didn't offer to drive us. He summoned us. Richard had to wait in the car.
But you went in?
She nodded. They've got a guy called Troy.
Silly name.
But a very smart guy. He's young, and he's very good with computers. I guess he's what they call a hacker.
And?
He just got partial access to one of the government systems in Washington. He found out they put a federal agent in here, undercover. At first they assumed it was you. Then they checked a little further and found out it was a woman, and she's actually been here for weeks.
I stared at her, not understanding. Teresa Daniel was off the books. The government computers knew nothing about her. Then I remembered Duffy's laptop with the Justice Department logo as the screensaver. I remembered the modem wire trailing across the desk, going through the complex adapter, going into the wall, hooking up with all the other computers in the world. Had Duffy been compiling private reports? For her own use? For post-action justification?
I hate to think what they're going to do to a woman.
Elizabeth shuddered visibly and looked away. I made it as far as the hallway, then I stopped dead. There were no cars, and 12 miles of road before I would even begin to get anywhere. 3 hours fast walk, 2 hours running.
Forget it,
Elizabeth called.
Nothing to do with you.
I turned around and stared in at her.
Forget it, she said again. They'll be doing it right now. It'll be all over soon.
The second time I ever saw Sergeant First Class Dominique Cole was the third day she worked for me. She was wearing green battle dress pants and a khaki T-shirt. It was very hot. I remember that. We were having some kind of a major heat wave. Her arms were tanned. She had the kind of skin that looks dusty in the heat. She wasn't sweating. The T-shirt was great. She had her tapes on it. Cole on the right and U.S. Army on the left, both of them kicked up just a little by the curve of her breasts. She was carrying the file I had given her. It had gotten a little thicker, padded out with her notes.
I'm going to need a partner,
she said to me. I felt a little guilty. Her third day and I hadn't even partnered her up. I wondered whether I'd given her a desk, or a locker, or a room to sleep in. You met a guy called Frasconi yet?
Tony? I met him yesterday, but he's a lieutenant.
I shrugged. I don't mind commissioned and non-commissioned working together. There's no regulation against it. If there was, I'd ignore it anyway. You got a problem with it?
She shook her head. But maybe he does.
Frasconi? He won't have a problem.
So will you tell him?
Sure, I said. I made a note for myself on a slip of blank paper. Frasconi, Cole, partners. I underlined it twice, so I would remember. Then I pointed at the file she was carrying. What have you got?
Good news and bad news, she said. Bad news is their system for signing out eyes-only papers all shot to hell. Could be routine inefficiency, but more likely it's been deliberately compromised to conceal stuff that shouldn't be happening.
Who's the guy in question?
A pointy head called Gorowski. Uncle Sam recruited him right out of MIT. A nice guy, by all accounts. Supposed to be very smart.
Is he Russian?
She shook her head. Polish, from a million years ago. No hint of any ideology.
Is he a Red Sox fan up at MIT?
Why?
They're all weird. Check it.
It's probably blackmail.
So what's the good news? She opened her file.
This thing they're working on is a kind of small missile, basically.
Who are they working with?
Honeywell and the General Defense Corporation.
And?
This missile needs to be slim, so it's going to be sub-caliber. The tanks use 120-millimeter cannons, but the thing is going to be smaller than that.
By how much?
Nobody knows yet, but they're working on the sabot design right now. The sabot is a kind of sleeve that surrounds the thing to make it up to the right diameter.
I know what a sabot is. She ignored me.
It's going to be a discarding sabot, which means it comes apart and falls away immediately after the thing leaves the gun muzzle. They're trying to figure whether it has to be a metal sabot or whether it could be plastic. Sabot means boot, from the French. It's like the missile starts out wearing a little boot.
I know that. I speak French. My mother was French.
Like sabotage, she said, from old French labor disputes. Originally, it meant to smash new industrial equipment by kicking it.
With your boots. She nodded.
Right.
So what's the good news again?
The sabot design isn't going to tell anybody anything. Nothing important, anyway. It's just a sabot, so we've got plenty of time.
Okay. But make it a priority. With Frasconi. You'll like him.
You want to get a beer later?
Me? She looked right at me.
If all ranks can work together, they should be able to have a beer together, right?
Okay, I said.
Dominique Cole looked nothing at all like the photographs I had seen of Teresa Daniel, but it was a blend of both their faces I saw in my head. I left Elizabeth Beck with her book and headed up to my original room. I felt more isolated up there, safer. I locked myself in the bathroom and took my shoe off, opened the heel, and fired up the email device. There was a message from Duffy waiting. No activity at warehouse. What are they doing? I ignored it and hit new message and typed, "We lost Teresa Daniel." 4 words, 18 letters, 3 spaces. I stared at them for a long time, put my finger on the send button, but I didn't press it. I went to backspace instead and erased the message. It disappeared from right to left. The little cursor ate it up. I figured I would send it only when I had to, when I knew for sure. I sent, "Possibility your computer is penetrated." There was a long delay, much longer than the usual 90 seconds. I thought she wasn't going to answer. I thought she must be ripping her wires out of the wall. But maybe she was just getting out of the shower or something, because about 4 minutes later she came back with a simple, "Why?" I sent, "Talk of a hacker with partial access to government systems." She sent, "Mainframes or LANs." I had no idea what she meant. I sent, "Don't know." She asked, "Details?" I sent, "Just talk. Are you keeping a log on your laptop?" She sent, "Hell no." I sent, "Anywhere?" She sent, "Hell no." I sent, "Elliot?" There was another 4 minute delay. Then she came back with, "Don't think so." I asked, "Think or no?" She sent, "Think." I stared at the tiled wall in front of me, breathed out. Elliot had killed Teresa Daniel. It was the only explanation. Then I breathed in. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe he hadn't. I sent, "Are these emails vulnerable?" We had been emailing back and forth furiously for more than 60 hours. She had asked for news of her agent. I had asked for her agent's real name, and I had asked in a way that definitely wasn't gender neutral. Maybe I had killed Teresa Daniel. I held my breath until Duffy came back with, "Our email is encrypted. Technically might be visible as code, but no way is it readable." I breathed out and sent, "Sure?" She sent, "Totally." I sent, "Coded how?" She sent, "NSA, billion-dollar project." That cheered me up, but only a little. Some of NSA's billion-dollar projects are in the Washington Post before they're even finished,
and communications snafus screw more things up than any other reason in the world. I sent, check with Elliot immediately about computer logs. She sent, will do. Progress? I typed, none. Then I deleted it and sent, soon. I thought it might make her feel better. I went all the way down to the ground floor hallway. The door to Elizabeth's parlor was standing open. She was still in the armchair. Dr. Zhivago was face down in her lap, and she was staring out the window at the rain. I opened the front door and stepped outside. The metal detector squawked at the Beretta in my pocket. I closed the door behind me and headed straight across the carriage circle and down the driveway. The rain was hard on my back. It ran down my neck. But the wind helped me. It blew me west, straight toward the gatehouse. I felt light on my feet. Coming back again was going to be harder. I would be walking directly into the wind, assuming I was still walking at all. Paulie saw me coming. He must have spent his whole time crouched inside the tiny building, prowling from the front windows to the back windows, watching like a restless animal in its lair. He came out in his slicker. He had to duck his head and turn sideways to get through the door. He stood with his back against the wall of his house, where the eaves were low. But the eaves didn't help him. The rain drove horizontally under them. I could hear it lashing against the slicker, hard and loud and brittle. It drove against his face and ran down it like torrents of sweat. He had no hat. His hair was plastered against his forehead. It was dark with water. I had both hands in my pockets, with my shoulders hunched forward and my face ducked into my collar. My right hand was tight around the Beretta. The safety was off. But I didn't want to use it. Using it would require complicated explanations, and he would only be replaced. I didn't want to have him replaced until I was ready to have him replaced, so I didn't want to use the Beretta. But I was prepared to. I stopped 6 feet from him, out of his reach. "We need to talk," I said.
"I don't want to talk."
"You want to arm wrestle instead?" His eyes were pale blue, and his pupils were tiny. I guessed his breakfast had been taken entirely in the form of capsules and powder.
"Talk about what?"
"New situation." He said nothing. "What's your MOS? MOS is an Army acronym. The Army loves acronyms. It stands for Military Occupational Specialty. And I used the present tense, what is, not what was. I wanted to put him right back there. Being ex-military is like being a lapsed Catholic. Even though they're way in the back of your mind, the old rituals still exert a powerful pull. Old rituals, like obeying an officer.
11 bang bang,
he said, and smiled. Not a great answer. 11 bang bang was grunt slang for 11B, which meant 11 Bravo, infantry, which meant combat arms. Next time I face a 400-pound giant with veins full of meth and steroids, I would prefer it if his MOS had been mechanical maintenance or typewriting, not combat arms. Especially a 400-pound giant who doesn't like officers and who had served 8 years in Fort Leavenworth for beating up on one. "Let's go inside," I said. "It's wet out here." I said it with the kind of tone you develop when you get promoted past captain. It's a reasonable tone, almost conversational. It's not the sort of tone you use as a lieutenant. It's a suggestion, but it's an order, too. It's heavy with inclusion. It says, "Hey, we're just a couple of guys here. We don't need to let formalities like rank get in our way, do we?" He looked at me for a long moment. Then he turned and slid sideways through his door, ducked his chin to his chest so he could get through. Inside, the ceiling was about 7 feet high. It felt low to me. His head was almost touching it. I kept my hands in my pockets. Water from his slicker was pooling on the floor. The house stank with a sharp, acrid animal smell, like a mink, and it was filthy. There was a small living room that opened to a kitchen area. Beyond the kitchen was a short hallway with a bathroom off it and a bedroom at the end. That was all. It was smaller than a city apartment, but it was all dressed up to look like a miniature, standalone house. There was mess everywhere, unwashed dishes in the sink,
used plates and cups and articles of athletic clothing all over the living room. There was an old sofa opposite a new television set. The sofa had been crushed by his bulk. There were pill bottles on shelves, on tables, everywhere. Some of them